Court of Appeals, in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as this court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Judge Mannion is not with us this morning. Being a judge is a more dangerous occupation than one might suppose, doubtless having to do with all these heavy papers, and he has broken his collarbone. But he is available in South Bend and will be participating by speakerphone. So if a disembodied voice asks you a question, the voice is attached to Judge Mannion from South Bend.
Obviously a technological glitch.
Hello?
What do we have to do?
Right.
Hello?
Nothing can go wrong. Go wrong. Yes, we can hear you. Can you hear us?
Just barely. One moment, let me pass you through to the judge.
Maybe you'll be hearing a lot of questions like, can you speak more loudly?
I think this is just an excuse by Judge Mannion to avoid coming to Chicago. I had to come from Milwaukee to get here.
I heard all of that.
Okay.
All right.
We are ready to proceed. I understand that Ms. Gambino is not yet here. Is that correct? Our first case will be moved and become now the ninth case this morning. We'll hear argument now in the case of Hardy against Floyd Memorial Hospital.
Poor lawyer on the second. In that case, if he's here, the other lawyer, he has to wait till.
Mr. Smith.
Good morning, Your Honor. Let me begin by saying that we think that this case boils down to a difference in whether the circumstances here fall under Groom versus Lau Industries or whether it falls under Collins versus State of Illinois. And we say that because Collins, admittedly an older case, does discuss the concept of looking to subtle differences in treatment that can include subtle distinctions. Discrimination can include subtle distinctions in the terms and conditions of employment beyond a salary. Why we think Groove does not necessarily apply is that Groove quit 20 minutes after she was notified of the job change, and she was picked for the job switch because she was not a strong supervisor, whereas our client was a stellar employee, and the appellees have admitted that. Also, the credibility of Groove was suspect, given the argument that she needed to care for her husband when that wasn't necessarily true. We think that if you take a look at the circumstances of how this all came about, that our client did in fact suffer an adverse employment act. The second shift's job was harder because there were more instruments to keep up with. The employees were harder to deal with, and the evidence of that is that the predecessor in that position had quit and the hospital couldn't find anybody to take that job. We think that our client was a better candidate, and I realize that's not the deciding factor, but she had more seniority, she had a master's degree in management, she had engaged in outreach to the community, to local events on behalf of the hospital. She'd advised other freestanding labs in the area. She was acted as the educational coordinator for the medical technology students at the University of Louisville. She had done everything she could to be a stellar employee and to improve herself throughout her career there. We think then that the concept of pretext is that, first of all, the appellee stated that the second shift, that she was chosen for the second shift because of the way the various facets of the lab were broken down. And yet, on the second shift, the supervisor would be over all parts of the laboratory operation, so that brings that excuse into question. The job switch and this reorganization was discussed with the male before the decision was finalized, and yet there was no discussion with Ms. Hardy. The administration let the word get out before she was even had a chance to tell her employees. And we think that it's very important to note that there was nobody in the job that she was asked to take over, either before or after. And also, there's testimony that that second ship was an unruly ship that nobody really wanted. And we need to also point out that this woman is in nearing the twilight of her career. She's been there almost 30 years. She was in her 50s. And sending her to the second ship would have turned her life upside down, as well as, she suspects, subjected her to being set up. Or she didn't know what was going to happen when she went on that second shift.
Are you arguing that any move from a first shift job to a second shift job is an adverse job action?
No, Your Honor.
Or only in this fact-specific case?
No, but what I'm arguing is that when you look at this, there's more than just a shift in your start and end times at your job, and that's what we're asking the court to take notice of. A couple of the cases
that
were...
They had some employees were harder to work with on the second shift. I mean, that could be equally true of first shift.
Well, sure, but it
knows.
Wasn't.
Who can control that?
We also think, though, the fact that the job was open creates the question of fact as to whether or not this was a bona fide offer or whether she was being set up. And I realize that, you know, a jury may not find, might not believe her account of events, but we think that she should be given the opportunity to make that showing. Some of the cases cited by the appellee that talk about how a shift transfer can't be an adverse employment, I usually say something like a shift transfer without more, as was stated in Tyler versus InSpat Inland. And Smart versus Ball State talks about other forms of
adverse. What is your best evidence that your client was chosen because of her sex?
We think that the best evidence is looking at the totality of all the circumstances.
No, what is the best evidence? All evidence is not the best evidence. I'm asking you to tell me what, in your view, is the best evidence.
Well, granted, we don't have a lot of great evidence. They didn't say bad things about her as being a female, but we think that if you take a look at the comparison, that it jumps out at you. There was some minor comment about the man that made the decisions ate lunch with this Mr. Hoskins, the male supervisor. We think that maybe that just Mr. Whittisle just wanted some other guys around on the day shift, and we think that's wrong. And again, I say that in the year 2002, it's difficult to find someone that's going to come right out and say exactly what they think. People have a way of couching that in terms that to avoid detection or to avoid getting
you
the
haven't listened recently to the majority leader of the Senate, have you?
A little bit, yes. I think I might have heard a thing about that. But at any rate,
let me ask you hypothetically, if everything would be the same here, and the move to second shift included a $50 a week pay raise or something like that, then would you have an adverse shift?
It depends. I think, again, you've got to look at the totality of the circumstances. Had they brought her in, when they brought in Mr. Hoskins to talk it over and let her have as much input as they did him, then we think it might be a different ballgame. But that's not what happened. They sprung this on her as a surprise. And granted, just anybody that, you know, if you've been in a job in that long, to say that it's not adverse to suddenly find yourself, your life upended and on a late shift where you're never going to see your family again, as well as all of the attendant circumstances that we think bring this into question, it's a big deal. It's an adverse employment act. So we think that she obviously has a prima facie case because she was a female. She was more qualified than the male. She was treated adversely. And we think that the male was selected to keep another male on the day shift. As I say, she has been a stellar employee throughout her career. There's no question about that. And we think that this fits more under the jurisprudence in Collins versus Illinois, where we are looking to the more subtle differences in treatment and looking beyond just the mere change in shift. And in fact, the change in shift wasn't going to, I don't know whether it had any increase in pay or not, but it doesn't really matter when you look at all the other facets in this case that come together to show that she was treated so much differently than the male. As I say, also, Mr. Hoskins testified with that, someone testified, I don't have exact citation on that, but he was grumbling about the change, and even Mr. Hoskins said that he thought Ms. Hardy would do fine in the job. Ms. Hardy had been a pretty aggressive supervisor throughout her career there. She had been trying to better herself from day one and had gone through a number of courses, gotten a number of certifications. The second shift was being supervised by a pager, as was the third shift. So we wonder whether there was even the need for a second or third shift supervisors. See the white lights. Sit back. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Ryan.
May it please the court, my name is John Ryan, and I represent Defendant Appellee Floyd Memorial Hospital in the appeal brought by Ms. Hardy. As Mr. Smith alluded to, I think that there are two issues that require your service today. First, was there an adverse employment action which would substantiate the prima facie case of sex discrimination? And number two, whether or not, if that is the case, and there is a prima facie case of sex discrimination established, whether or not Ms. Hardy has advanced evidence sufficient to support a finding or a issue of pretext that would require a trial in this matter. And I believe that the easier of the two issues is with respect to the adverse employment action. This court has, over the course of the last few years, applied substantial emphasis on what is an adverse employment action.
I don't know. I think that that's the harder of the two issues. Now, I can remember working at the breweries every summer when I was a kid, and always working second or third shifts, hating it. No one wanted to work second or third shift. What if your law firm changed your hours to come in at 4 o'clock and work until midnight every day? You wouldn't consider that an adverse job action?
Well, no.
You wouldn't?
Well, in my personal...
That's doubtless because he works midnight every day.
That's right.
Well, that's right. That's third shift, then. Midnight to late in the morning.
We don't have shift at the law firm. It's all one. But I can understand the subjective disfavor that one might have in working second shift or third shift as opposed to first shift. But I think that the court has also been clear that subjective disfavor for the job or an involuntary transfer does not have a role or should play a role in a determination of whether there's an adverse employment action when the benefits, the pay, and the responsibilities are the same. And I think that that's exactly what happened here. We were faced with a situation, given the circumstances surrounding the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, where Medicare reimbursement rates had gone down drastically. And as a result of that, there was a big push from management in the hospital for each department to cut their costs. Mr. Weitzel was faced with a situation, the lab director was faced with a situation, where he needed to cut his costs. And what he did was reorganize the laboratory. He was put in a difficult situation because he was forced to consolidate supervision of departments that were previously supervised by multiple employees. And there's no doubt that Ms. Hardy was a good worker, and Mr. Weitzel has never doubted that she was a good worker. He didn't doubt that Mr. Hoskins, the male counterpart in all this, was a good supervisor as well. Mr. Hoskins at the time had been there 23 years. Ms. Hardy had been there 29 years. And so as a result of that, what he had to do was look to other aspects with respect to what he believed would put the laboratory in the best position for future growth. And so what he ultimately decided was that he was going to downsize the clinical chemist position, which was in a position held by a physician, Dr. Walter Mastropolo. An employee of 17 years who ultimately was terminated in all this, and gave Ms. Hardy an opportunity to stay on and with the same pay, benefits, and responsibilities, the only change being that she would be working on the second shift as opposed to the first shift. I think that any dislike that she would have had would have been based upon subjective disfavor. And I think that the facts of this matter are very, very much aligned with the facts of the Grube case that Mr. Smith pointed out. Same situation. Employee was asked to go to the second shift, no other change in responsibilities, pay, or benefits, and she quit. The court, Judge Coffey, ultimately wrote an opinion which held that there was no adverse employment action based upon a change in shift alone. So that is the hospital's position with respect to whether or not there's an adverse employment action. Unless there are other questions, I'd like to move on to the issue of pretext. With respect to the issue of pretext, I've touched upon a couple things already. But I think the most important concept relies upon Mr. Smith's response to the question, what is the best evidence of pretext in this case? And I didn't really hear much from him as by way of a response. What we contend is that we had two substantial reasons why Ms. Hardy would be selected for involuntary transfer and that Mr. Hoskins would take over her responsibilities in the first shift. The two are, one, that the chemistry department was more financially important to the lab and more technically complex. Financially speaking, revenues of chemistry greatly outweighed the revenues that were obtained from the department that Ms. Hardy was supervising. The same goes for lab testing volume. Again, substantially greater in terms of the amount of volume that was generated out of the chemistry department as opposed to the hematology, coagulation, and blood banking departments. So for those two reasons, Mr. Weitzel believed that Mr. Hardy was better suited for the position because in real terms, the stability of the chemistry department was more important to the lab on first shift. The other issue is that Mr. Weitzel had complementary expertise in the areas of hematology and blood banking, an area that Ms. Hardy had overseen in her supervisory capacity. And for this reason, Mr. Weitzel was going to be able to fill in the gaps that Mr. Hoskins would not with respect to running or supervising those departments on first shift. Ms. Hardy would have had to take some more training to get up to speed on chemistry. There were 15 instruments. She was going to be taking on a lot more by way of testing volume, and she had not previously had that within her job description. So overall, we believe that given the circumstances in this case, there was no adverse employment action. There's no evidence for pretext. Ms. Hardy, in response with respect to pretext, only demonstrated why she was more suited for the job. She did not dispute or in any way counter the veracity of the reasons provided by Mr. Weitzel. So given those circumstances and the lack of evidence with respect to pretext, it is the hospital's position that there was no adverse employment action, no pretext, and for that reason we'd ask that the summary disposition of Judge Barker be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Ryan. Anything further, Mr. Smith?
Yes, just briefly, Your Honor. I want to point out one thing. The volume and the revenue of the various facets of these laboratories have nothing to do with who is supervising the laboratory. Ms. Hardy could do that as well as Mr. Hoskins. The Forsyth versus City of Dallas case talks about the transfer being equivalent to a demotion, where we have someone transfer without a loss of pay and benefits, but the court held that it was a more prestigious job that the employee had at one point when they were transferred to another uniform position. They considered it to be a demotion. That's what we think this is. We think that anybody around that hospital is going to see that her activities in the community, her activities both boosting the image of the hospital, and yet she's the one switched the second shift. And as far as the comparison to Grube, understand that Ms. Hardy waited 11 months. She filed an internal grievance that went nowhere. She was told that when she took the part-time position that she could be looking for other full-time employment within the hospital. The hospital did nothing to help her with that. She didn't quit until she had to get a full-time job somewhere. And while it said that Mr. Hoskins was better for certain parts of the lab for the first shift, why is it on the second shift she'd be able to do all of that? It doesn't ring true. It rings like a pretextual answer. We think that the evidence of the Adverse Employment Act, which is the totality of the circumstances, if you compare the two candidates and to the statements that the employer has made to support their argument, we think clearly there's an Adverse Employment Act, and we think a lot of that also goes to show pretext, which is something that Collins states also, is that the evidence of the prima facie case can also serve as evidence of pretext if it's strong enough. Of course, that's also in Hicks, St. Mary's Honors System versus Hicks. quick mention, Dr. Mastropolo is not a comparable. He didn't supervise anyone. He was acting more in the role of a consultant. So just that's not really relevant to the discussion at hand. We just think, Your Honors, that this could have been handled differently had she been brought in like Mr. Hoskins was. And the way this was handled, we think that it evidences a bias based on gender. And we think that Ms. Hardy should have at least a chance to present her evidence to a jury. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. The case will be taken under advisement.